Morning, I'd like to bring this House Fisheries Committee meeting to order. It is Thursday, February 20th, and it's 10:04, and present are Representative Christ Tompkins, Representative Feige, myself, Chair Seaton, Representative Olson is excused, and we do not have any bills for action on today's calendar, so we can go ahead and start without a quorum of the committee. And so today we are looking at three issues. Those are sea otters in southeast Alaska and their relationship to fisheries. We'll talk with the Department of Fish and Game Sport Fish Director about ADF&G response to DVEX and other invasive tunicates in the Sitka area. And we'll also have the DNR Deputy Commissioner Ed Vogels to talk to us about the MOU and other issues around the Alodia and other freshwater aquatic invasives. And that MOU that we're talking about is one between DNR, DEC, and ADF&G regarding invasive species. So that's our concentrations today. If members wish to talk about any other species or any other directions there, that'll be fine. If people aren't prepared to give us the direct answers, they can get back to us those later, but we're happy to put those on the table and ask those questions, and the presenters are, if questions come up that you're not prepared for today, we haven't notified you of those specific things, we'd be willing to have you get back to the committee with those questions later. Anything else for this time? So today we're going to start with the Peterborough Borough Mayor, Mark Jensen. Mark, would you come forward? And welcome, and would you introduce yourself for the record, and then go ahead with your presentation.
Well, good morning, and thanks for the opportunity to testify in front of the Fisheries Committee. My name is Mark Jensen. I am currently the Borough Mayor of Petersburg. I'm not here necessarily representing the Petersburg Borough. I mentioned to the Assembly last Friday when we had a meeting that I was going to testify in front of this Fisheries Committee. I'm more here to give record of how sea otters have affected my family directly, and represent the communities in southeast and the fishermen on this issue. I'm third generation in Petersburg. My grandpa moved from Norway in the early 1900s to the east coast of the United States, then to Seattle, up to Petersburg. It was a young community. My dad was born there in 1920. I was born there in 55. I have two sons. Oldest boy, Bill, is 21 years old. He's currently a junior at Bozeman, Montana State University, taking mechanical engineering and business as a minor, but he'll be a fisherman. That's in his blood. Youngest boy, Alan, is a senior in high school this year. He's going to Florida to school, Embry-Riddle, to take aerospace engineering, and he has no desire to be a fisherman. So I guess I don't blame him. But this presentation that I got from Phil Doherty from Southeast Alaska Fisheries Dive Association, he put it together for me, is pretty short. It has some maps I'd like to talk to. This is first map shows where otters were planted in Southeast, in the 60s. The Barrier Islands, south of Craig, the Morrill Islands up by Sea Otter Sound, and I think this area is probably the one that has seen the strongest growth in the reproduction of the sea otters. This map kind of shows the concentration of otters. The bigger the red dot, the size of the little groups of otters that they have seen. You can see the largest dot is 36 to 51. If otters do multiply by 12 to 14% a year, and you take the 2012 number, you see on this chart, the Verena Gill is the one that compiled this. Currently, there would be 30,000 otters in southeast Alaska. Representative Price Tompkins gave me a chart, and I believe you have it, or a statistic, tagging statistic by hunt origin. And if you look at the whole statewide harvest for 2013, it was 1,750 otters. If they grow by 13% in 2013-14, that number would go up 3,800 otters. So even with the harvest by natives, the population in Southeast is growing twice as much as the state harvest. And it's kind of a concern of mine that we're not doing enough to help the, manage them. And I know it's a federally managed species, but it'd be nice if the state could get more involved in encouraging the federal government to move on this. And I'm trying to find the right chart. It'd be better to show you what's currently happening around Petersburg area. Maybe this one. The red indicates areas closed or negatively affected due to sea otters. And this, I don't know if Phil Doherty put this together or who did, but I don't know if you can see on the where I'm pointing. Let's see, Sumner Straits. A little shaky here, I'm kind of nervous. Sumner Straits, there's been local people from Petersburg harvesting otters along this area up in behind Level Island for the last 4 or 5 years. They go down there and hunt during the winter. They might, between the 3 or 4 natives that go down there, they might get close to 200 otters. They think, well, we've got them beat back enough where it's going to make an impact. They go back 2 months later and they're there again. And some of the most productive grounds near Petersburg. Here's Mitkov. I wish I could blow this up. I don't know how. But Petersburg is right here. Wrangell's over here. Stikine River is one of the most productive areas, the Stikine River flats left in Southeast, and Duncan Canal, which is right here. Level Island, I don't know if you can see it on this map, is right here. This is Mitchell Point. The natives that are hunting down there now figure there's between 200 and 500 otters from Mitchell Point up into Little Duncan, this little niche in the side of Duncan Canal. Friend of mine fishing down here in Cochise Bay, right at the mouth of Duncan Canal, put 13 crab pots in Cochise Bay. Left them for 3 days, heavily digged, went back, the bait wasn't even disturbed, there wasn't even a hair crab in the pot. So that's how dead the bottom is from these otters. 8 minutes away in his 28-foot skiff, he was having very good fishing. So that's just just to show you how close to our community this is coming. It's going to really affect the small boats. I mean, currently the Dungeness fishery is set up in 4 tiers of pot levels, 75 pot permit, there's 150 pot permit, 225 pot permit, and then a 300 pot permit, which is the largest. You can stack them together on one boat, but can't exceed 300 pots. In 91, when I got into the Dungeness fishery, I built myself a 28-foot aluminum skiff, fished out of that for years, and that was gill netting as well. So now I have a 36-foot aluminum boat that I fished for 20 years, sold out of the fishery in 2011. My older son that I talked about a little while ago fished with me for years. Now he's off on a sailing boat and earning his tuition at college and, got good work ethics. None of us, generally fishermen are there for welfare. We just want to be able to work, and this is going to have an adverse effect on that. So anyway, my son went on sailing and we sold the Dungeness permit because I didn't see a future in it, where we used to fish where there was 2-3 boats. Now there's anywhere up to 20 boats just because of they had to go where the crab are. So they just, moved into where the grounds are productive. So I guess that's pretty much all I really wanted to say, is just give you a picture of how it affected myself and my family. And my son probably would have had that permit in his name. We sold it and bought a power drill permit. I don't think otters eat salmon yet. So then I bought a herring permit as well. So I was able to diversify, but to see where young kids or young adults can't buy a 75-pot permit and go out and make a go of it and expand and grow into another fishery, it's kind of disturbing. So I don't know what we could do about it. I know it's a difficult situation, federally managed, but would hope the state would do something to, encourage some kind of a better management plan before. I mean, you're potentially looking at a loss of, tens of millions of dollars annually in our region, Southeast, less than 100,000 population. So that's a big amount of money, and a lot of it comes in the fall. The fall Dungeness season, as well as the dive fishery, which I know Phil Doherty was here earlier this month, and I don't know if you met with young, I believe you met with Price Tompkins, Representative Tompkins, so you've heard the dive side of the story, I hope. I mean, they self-taxed themselves to create their own fishery, and now they're being affected as well. So if you have any questions, I don't know if I said everything I wanted to, but I think I made my case. Thanks.
Yeah. Thanks. Questions? I guess I had one. We had a presentation last year showing the difference in habitat as far as the kelp and all when there were large sea urchin populations mm-hmm. and when there weren't. Have you seen any change in the kelp beds or anything else in these areas? Or?
Well, I haven't really noticed, but I guess that is a point on the prairie water side, is that if there's, I believe this is what you're getting at, if there's less urchins and the otters eat the urchins and the kelp beds are healthier. And we harvest our kelp for a roaring kelp fishery that I'll be involved in starting next month down in Sea Otter Sound. And it's appropriately named because there's otters all over the place. Area, one of the areas that are planted. I don't know. I haven't, Mr. Seaton, I haven't obviously seen it. So.
Right. One other thing that we were looking at previously on helping those more localized areas in the hunt was that there was restrictions on the use of the sea otter to culturally traditional items. Did that get cured up? The problem was somebody couldn't make a teddy bear because they couldn't find one in a museum that had a teddy bear made out of sea otter fur, and therefore it wasn't a culturally traditional item. Has that been resolved, and are the natives that are harvesting the sea otter pelts down there been able to get more of a market for their products?
You know, I'm not sure. I know there's a couple of tanneries that operate out of Sitka that do a pretty good production. In Petersburg, the Petersburg Indian Association had purchased a couple of commercial sewing machines that natives could use, and I don't know how involved that is still, but there's one individual there, Ralph Strickland, who bought his own machine. He probably harvests, I don't know, 50, 60 otters a year, and along with seal, and makes some pretty nice handicrafts. As far as the change in the definition of significantly altered, I think they just did something about that, the federal government, but I'm not sure if it made that big of a difference. I think it made it so, if I understand what they did, the natives were less feared of getting sighted if they went out and not following the rules. So,
if you have a chance, if you could forward that name to us and so that we can contact him, because that's one thing that we had passed. I think we passed a resolution on asking that to be relaxed, and I'd like to follow up on it to see if it's been effective or if there's something else we need to do on that front, and if there's any way we can be effective.
So. I can get the name of all four of the main harvesters around the Petersburg area.
If you wouldn't mind, we'd appreciate it.
I wouldn't mind a bit.
And then we'll make the contacts and find out if there's anything else that we can do that could make a difference in that economic base for folks that are allowed to harvest those anyway.
But I'm sure you can see my concerns with how close they are to Petersburg. I've seen otters wipe out a small bay in the course of a winter. So, and that happened about 16 years ago in Rowan Bay in the lower Chatham Strait. Was there late one August before the season closed, just scouting around because the pots needed to sit for a while before they were productive. So this young man, Brian White, there, was fishing with me. We did a tour around southeast. We went into Rowan Bay. There was still crab pots in the bay, and the season closes August 15th. There's a few crab. You wouldn't expect much after being fished for 2 months. Went back the next May with my family. My youngest boy was just tall enough to see over the rail. I have a picture of him with a little pole. It's got the bobber on it so he didn't stick himself with the hook. And there was no crab in the bay, and it was just rafts of sea otters everywhere. So, just a little bit of local knowledge here.
Well, thank you, and that's we appreciate you coming in. Is there any other questions? Don't see any. Thank you for coming in and presenting on that issue of concern to the area.
You're welcome. Hopefully enlighten you a little bit.
Next up, we have West Department Fish and Game Sportfish Director, Mr. Charlie Swanton. So, welcome, and would you go ahead and put yourself on the record for the committee and proceed with giving us some information on what's happening in the Sitka area on DVACs.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Charlie Swanton. I'm the director for the Division of Sportfish with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. Thank you for the opportunity to give you an update with regards to DVACs, or the colonial tunicate infestation in Whiting Harbor and Sitka. I believe that there's been several updates over the course of time to this body as well as others, and I'm just going to briefly go through the progress that's been made since the last time that we had this. There's plenty of information provided in the brief that I outlined for you, so I'm just going to go through the high points of that, and if you have any questions with regards to that, I can either try and address them here, or I can certainly follow up, and I appreciate the opportunity to do that.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, as many of you know, in 2010, DVEX was discovered in Whiting Harbor, which is adjacent to the city of Sitka. That was the first known identification of that invasive species. Progress has been made with regards to that in the form of a proceeding. We've done two surveys, one in 2011 and then a more comprehensive survey in 2012. There's some maps in the back of the brief that will outline that information. In essence, we received a CIP in FY13 to look at dealing with the remnants of an aquatic farm, as well as conducting containment and eradication activities. So the first approach was to do a more detailed survey in 2012 with Fish and Game staff. In essence, it was a more refined transects. In other words, the transects that we were looking at were more closer together than what we had done in 2011. And the purposes of that were twofold. One was to identify where in the coverage within Whiting Harbor that the tunicate was, and to look at concentrations, but also as a means with which to identify and map for the purposes of submitting a request for proposals for activities by a contractor to eradicate and or control. So that was the first phase of it. In essence, last April we went out for requests for bids. We had about a 6-week period in time. We received no input from any of the private contractors for a variety of reasons. That's laid out in here, whether they had previous workloads or the scope was a little bit broader than what they wanted.
Clarification. So you put out an RFP and you got no responses to the RFP?
That is correct.
Okay.
And with some follow-up conversations with some of the folks that were interested, we had conversations with the Smithsonian institution that have done some work in this arena. And that's outlined on page 2, where we started in and we're continuing to have conversations. They submitted a scope of work, interested in working with us for the control and eradication processes. And we've reviewed that and we're refining that and hope to have a contract with them likely by the end of this month or certainly going into next month. With the activities that they will be taking place in August of this year to essentially test various treatments for inducing mortality in Whiting Harbor.
And that, did you say Smithsonian?
Yes. Let me see where it's located. Smithsonian Environmental Research Center. There's a citation, or at the top there's a marine pollution bulletin. They put out a paper on some aquarium size or aquarium scale trials of various treatments for inducing mortality, where they've tested it in terms of various time scales. And the next phase of that will be to look at 1 to 3 meter enclosures with the same treatment scales, whether it be cement dust. There's a number of treatments that they are going to investigate, and we'll see which one works best. And that'll take place starting in August. And then there's a timeline on page 2 that goes through the various aspects of data analysis and results and collaborative. What we're planning on doing is going into a collaborative effort with these folks and submitting a proposal to the North Pacific Research Board for full-scale eradication. Typically, the way these things operate would be that a granting agency would probably be funding the work that we're currently going to be investigating. In other words, the treatment trials, see what works, and move forward. So we just kind of reverse the order in hopes that we can leverage the CIP monies to do a full-scale eradication and then subsequent monitoring, I think, through like 2017 through 2018. So that's the plan of attack. The last bullet on page 2 provides the financial information and various funding sources that we've used over the course of time in this process, from U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and then all the way through to the CIP. And you can see that the balance of the CIP is about $431,000 at present time. On page 3, if I'm not moving too fast, these were essentially the lines jutting out from the shoreline, or essentially the transects that we dove on and then looked for presence. And as you can see, the distribution in terms of the colors up towards the head of the harbor, that's where the largest concentration was and still is. And it makes perfectly good sense when you think about it in the context of this particular tunicate was infested on aquatic farm infrastructure, whether it be lantern nets, lines, so on and so forth. And it is our belief that the coverage that exists now and the concentration is largely a function of the cleaning of those nets on the shoreline. In other words, lantern nets, burn them up, pressure wash them, break the material off of the lantern nets so that they function better, and then the tide moving those particulate material back into the water and colonies forming from that. The last page on the last map shows the concentrations and the populations both in 2011 and 2012. And the one thing I might add, because there was some concern by the local community and whatnot, but prior to we had some infrastructure that had not been cleaned up. There was a storm and it broke up some of that infrastructure, and some of it washed up on Neva Island, which is outside of Whiting Harbor. If you go to the top left-hand corner and drew a circle out there, that's approximately where that island is. And we did an extensive survey out there and found no colonies, no material out there. So it's that was a positive thing that we found with regards to the survey. So the two populations that have got circles and boxes around, that's the furthest out of the bay that we've been able to find any DVEX. So, and you know, for a scale, that's probably about, we're looking at about 3,000 feet, or about two-thirds of a mile or thereabouts out into the harbor, whereas you can see most of the concentration is at the head of the bay. And then there's a scale there for where we found it in 2011 and not in 2012, and those sorts of pieces of information. Now with regards to the Matrillids, which is the chain tunicate or the star tunicates.
Before we go on to there, let's see if people have questions on DVEX instead of going back. So I guess I had one. So the page 4 there is listing gray was sampled in both, or were not sampled. So is that what on our printouts appear as white lines?
The white lines are the transects that were done with regards to the surveys.
And I guess Was there nothing that was gray that was represents areas of whiting harbor that were not sampled? Oh, that's just the non-transect areas. It's not parts of a line. It's just everything that didn't have a transect on it. So then the yellow was found in 11 but not 12, and the red is that was in 12 but not in 11. So that would be essentially you're putting transects where we didn't have before, or the population has expanded?
Well, it could be either or. I mean, I think it's recognize the fact that the scale and the refinement of our survey in 2012 was, I'm not exactly sure, but I think that, you know, we were adding, you know, like three times as many transects in 12 or thereabouts. I mean, what we were looking for was a much more refined scale. So transects, for example, were, you know, maybe we did in 2011 one transect every 150 feet or 100 feet, whereas in 2012 we were doing like a transect every 50 feet. Right. So we were much more refined in our survey in 12.
So it could be a combination of those two. We hadn't sampled that particular area, or the red shows an expansion of area, and we just don't know at this point.
Yeah, you know, you can look at it, you know, one or the other. I don't think that there's been any great expansion as much as it may have. We missed it in 11 and got it in 12, or, you know, just the function of survey statistics.
And the island, what was the name of the island that was out there?
Neva Island.
Neva?
Yes.
Okay. Representative Chris Tompkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Why did Smithsonian not respond to your original RFP?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Christ Tompkins, I'm not aware of why they didn't, and I think that any answer to that question probably at this point would be probably on the speculative side.
Follow up? Another question? Whichever.
Thank you. Maybe it's related, although it may seem obliquely so. How would you describe Department of Fish and Game's staff capacity to tackle invasives in Alaska, be it DVEX and Sitka or Ewodia in South Central or Northern Pike? And do you feel you have the resources, staff resources, and or other resources needed to respond effectively?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Christ Tompkins, I guess the best answer that, you know, to that question is we're doing the best that we can with what we have, and we're fortunate to not be faced with the same situations that you know, states in the lower 48 are with various vectors and you know, and those sorts of things. So I think that part of it is geography, and part of it is that you know, we can learn from other states as to how to best thwart those sorts of threats. But we're doing an okay job of what we have, Mr. Chairman.
And I think that we have been extremely fortunate in this particular invasive species because it doesn't appear to be rapidly invasive. I mean, we could have other species that would be moving far and wide, much quicker with the response that we've been able to have. And I'm not blaming that on anyone. You know, we're trying to address that through the legislation and trying to get rapid response, and we're trying to make sure that you have the requested funds. But you know, it's to nobody's surprise that I don't think you are happy with what you've been able to accomplish to date. And you know that we aren't happy with that. And so I think that, you know, this is almost a very fortunate particular invasive that I think we have here, because it has moved so slow that even the legislature and the administration moving extremely slow hasn't gotten overwhelmed. and got into the really critical things, because if this was a more rapidly moving invasive, I guess you're not the commercial fishing manager, but I can imagine that if D-Vex was spreading around in the areas where the Sitka sacro herring fishery would take place, the only choice would be is to not to totally preclude that fishery. Because having a fishery in which you have same gear used, which gets kelp and other things, and then having that pumped onto a tender, you know, put on the record, you know, I own a tender. I mean, I've tendered herring forever, and you get all kinds of kelp and detritus when you're pumping herring into the hold. And then if you ran those to other ports and you dewater in those other ports, we would have a situation which I think Fish and Game would just be not able to conduct a fishery in the traditional manner if this was spreading around that area, because it would rapidly move to all of the other areas where those fish would be developed. So I guess another question that we're looking at, and I know in the lower 48 when they have quahog mussels or other things that are there, they actually decontaminate and quarantine every boat before it moves from one area to another, one state to another. So I guess part of the question is, if this would get into Sitka Harbor, has ADF&G, and we can talk to DNR as well, trying to figure out what would be the limitations on utilization and movement of vessels from those harbors, and have we looked at those kind of problems that would be there with a rapidly or a very, shall I say, voracious invasive species? And have there been conversations around that, around those kind of parameters of what would we do if we have a harbor in the state that becomes contaminated with a invasive and with vessel movement between that harbor and other harbors in the state?
Mr. Chairman, to address the first comments that you made, I'd like to say that when you're dealing with something that doesn't have a body of knowledge associated with it in terms of other states and how they've addressed specifically with regards to D-Vex, and it shows up in your backyard, and you don't have a lot to go on with regards to how to deal with it, and some of the other complexities associated with a very variable substrate, World War II refuse that is in that harbor, and those sorts of things. I'd have to say that although rapid is in the eyes of the beholder, I think that the department and I think the staff that we have, both commercial fisheries as well as sport fisheries division staff, have done a pretty darn good job. Now, it may not be as quick as folks would like, but I don't think that those folks recognize the difficulties with regards to dealing with something like this when you don't have a large body of knowledge and you don't have a lot of background information as to how others have dealt with this elsewhere. So, you know, on that front, I'm reasonably pleased with the progress that we've made, and I'm excited to have a partner that that will take some of this information and possibly assist others. And we are lucky. I don't disagree with that. And it has all to do with, you know, the species and reproductive rates, and you know, the challenges associated with, in this case, you know, temperature, you know, those sorts of things. Sometimes it's not bad to be lucky, but it's also, you don't want to live on it either. But you know, I'd like to address that one first. The second one, I think we're going to have to get back to you, because you know, authorities with regards to vessels and so on and so forth, and you know, in movement of vessels and those sorts of things, is certainly broader than just the Department of Fish and Game's authorities. So I'd have to answer that in more of a broader, you know, return back to that question, if that's fine with you.
That's fine, and I'm putting these issues on the table for making sure that thought patterns are going forward. And, you know, we are trying in the legislature, and it you know, we haven't gotten there yet either. Last legislature attempted to deal with this, and we didn't complete that structure. So, you know, there are impediments in the law that we're trying to get over. So I'm not placing this on ADF&G as saying that you guys haven't been, you know, have been the holdup, because we've got some laws that we need changing and we need to establish. So, but I do feel that we were lucky, and I'm glad we were lucky, and if it wasn't for DVACs being there, we probably wouldn't have been addressing the laws as rapidly as we are, even. And so we could be in a much more expensive situation in a future outbreak, because we have been lucky, and we appreciated what you've been dealing with, and, you know, trying to do that. And I am somewhat disappointed that, you know, our knowledge base is such that we have a partner that's going to do larger trials to see what will work on the species. And that's not your fault that we don't have the information on DVECs and how to control it. So we're developing that. But it is one of those things that I am glad that we are working on developing strategies that can be more broadly implemented, because if we don't get them developed now, we know as temperatures change and everything else, these things are coming. Problems will appear, and we better be ready to address them. And, you know, so I appreciate the RFPs and appreciate going forward. It is somewhat disappointing that we are still at the stage that we are doing box trials of see what works. That all has to be done. I'm not negating that's done. It's just really disappointing from everybody's concern, including yours, that we don't know, we can employ this technique to handle that on that species or on similar species. So I'm glad we're getting there. It's something that we hope to proceed, and that's, you know, why we've got some money in there and everything else. So, yeah. Representative Christoph.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I certainly appreciate the novelty that you're faced with, both as far as response techniques and existing scientific knowledge. It sounds like you can go to the library and check out a book, How to Eradicate Colonial Tunicate, you know, how to guide your writing that book to a certain extent. Part of my concern, I mean, first of all, I think all of us probably at this table feel that there should be more resources dedicated to ADF&G and other agencies to be able to respond so you guys can better do your job, but that you're doing a great job with what you have. Although I do have concern, not so much with actual action moving towards eradicating the species, in this case DVECs, but what would seem to be sort of common sense prevention techniques. I mean, I'm just looking at the chronology presented in the document you submitted to the committee, and removal of nets in the segment of aqua farm infrastructure in August 2011, and then in spring 2013 was signage in Whiting Harbor discouraging boaters from anchoring up there. And speaking locally, me being from Sitka, there's been, you know, widespread concern in Sitka that as soon as we knew that DVECs was in the harbor, we should have those signs up right away telling people not to be anchoring there or unnecessarily entering the harbor. And I just would like to highlight that I mean, a lot of these prevention techniques don't necessarily require scientific knowledge of the species.
Mr. Chair, to respond to that, what we've highlighted are floating buoys that are essentially right in the middle of the harbor to identify. We've had signage up there, I believe, for at least 2 or 3 years, that we also recognize the fact that land ownership there is an interesting mosaic at best. especially with the airport, so on and so forth, right there, proximate to those sorts of things. But we have identified and we have actually, warned and publicized this situation since shortly after it was discovered, and told boaters to stay out of there. We've closed it, which was what I was getting to with regards to the herring fishery. That area is closed, so we're keeping, traffic out of there. Although we may not have, blockaded it, it is certainly we've done what we can to turn around and thwart any sort of, vessels from moving in and out of there or any other potential vectors.
Representative Feige.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mariners and pilots have this thing in common. We don't necessarily like to trust in luck. We like to know exactly where we are in the three-dimensional space and avoid running into things so we come home safe at the end of the day. It's great that this stuff doesn't spread, we think, not very fast. I got to look at what is the risk that we're running here by not responding in a more aggressive manner. And I know there's certainly a bill or two that we've tried to address this with that is working its way through the system slowly. I think there's probably money issues that could help ease the task that you're faced with. But the risk is that this gets into the harbor and we have a massive disruption of our major fisheries in Southeast. And I think we have to look at that and stop worrying so much about the academic, gee, wouldn't it be nice to know all these little details about this, and simply get it done. So simply because of the risk of something that could be devastating is, while it may be moving slowly and perhaps the perceived risk is not as high, it is still a risk and it's a major problem if this stuff gets out of Whiting Harbor. We should be trying to whack it and smother it and poison it and whatever we have to do to make sure we don't have to go down the other path. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I don't see any other questions on DVEC, so thank you on that part. And would you go ahead and proceed then with the other invasives that we're talking about, or colonials?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With regard to the Batrillids that were identified in A and B Harbor and the work that's being done there to replace piling and floats, I was alerted that this question might come up, so I talked to area staff. And in essence, the herring fleet will be able to access A and B in the new floats, and they will be segregated or essentially separated from any sort of the replacement of those piling and whatnot. And the piling is part of the Corps of Engineers. The piling that have been infected are being removed and being shipped south. So that is, a positive with regards to that. Those species and where they're located. So that's how that's being dealt with. They have not been found elsewhere. So, we're essentially in concert with the city and the harbor master, making sure that there's a separation of the fleet from that. And it's like I said earlier, the fleet does not use any herring fishing in Whiting Harbor has been closed. So that's what we are doing with regards to that. So it seems to be progress in that regard. Mr. Chairman.
Is there any other we've got the commercial fleet closed. Is there a prohibition on sport or branches for herring to spawn on? Or have basically Whiting Harbor, especially at the upper end of Whiting Harbor, has it just kind of gotten the off limits for any utilization, subsistence, or sport, or anything else?
In the general sense, Mr. Chairman, that's my understanding, that we have prohibited as much activity in there as we possibly can. You know, the recreational or the boaters that are just out looking for anchorage or whatever else, we've encouraged them to stay out of that area as well. And any sort of transient boats, encourage them to stay out there as well through our educational efforts. So that's my understanding, Mr. Chairman.
And is that... That area hasn't traditionally been used for either spawn on kelp or spawn on cedar branches, or has it? Or?
Not to my knowledge, Mr. Chairman, but I'm not sure that I could get back to you. I mean, that particular activity is goes back quite a ways, and I don't know whether the historical record has shown that they have used that area in the past or whatnot, so I'm not positive that I can get back to you on that one.
But probably everybody in Sitka is well aware of the fact that there's this possible contamination and that they should use other areas for all activities?
I believe so, but it may be that Representative Christ Tompkins, is being a Sitka resident, might be more aware of that than I.
Thank you, Representative Craig Thompson.
I think there's pretty widespread local knowledge. It's received a lot of media attention. I mean, a lot of my concern, and part of my concern that, say, floating buoys were installed in 2013, is that there's a lot of transient traffic, arguably. That's how DVEX probably first got to Sitka. And you have non-resident pilots or boaters coming in and anchoring, and they might not know. But certainly among locals, there's widespread knowledge.
Mr. Chairman, to address that, is the department's belief that how DVEX got to Whiting Harbor was on infected aquaculture infrastructure and not vessels. And I don't have the information sitting in front of me, but there was genetic work done that traced it back to its origin that's pretty, I wouldn't say it's 100% conclusive, but I would say it's pretty conclusive that that's the culprit, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Have we instituted any policies that prevent aquaculture gear or other gear that hasn't been inspected or whatever from being brought into other areas of the state? Do we have a policy, or do we need some preventative control to say that there has to be some kind of certification or inspection before marine gear is brought from another area into the state?
There's another question from my list to turn around and give you the exact answer as opposed to any sort of general answer that I might have kicking on top of my head, Mr. Chairman.
That would be good, and if there, we'd appreciate that, and if there is something that we need to institute, we do have a bill that is making its way through the system, and if we need to add provisions on there, it'd be much better to know those now than next year and have to not only have a delay in which we could have more stuff brought into state, but also just the process of getting this issue addressed is, it's taken us more time than we wish. So, Representative Feige.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to get sort of some more information here on the Harbor Star and Golden Chain tunicates. They are invasive. They're not found naturally in Alaska's waters.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Feige, that is correct.
Where are they found in the world?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Feige, maybe I shouldn't have been so quick to use humor before. we started with regards to that, because I'm not sure with regards to worldwide distribution and the specific life history attributes and whatnot, but I can certainly get that for you.
Okay. And again, this is just for trying to figure this out. Do we know anything about how to kill this stuff? I mean, do we know? We obviously don't know if it's a huge threat. We don't think it's spreading as fast as other, or has the potential to spread as fast as D-Vex. But is this something worth eradicating in place now?
Mr. Chairman, I believe that most of the locations where this has been found is on the piling, and I'm not sure about the dock structures in the harbor, and that was where the piling was that was being replaced was being loaded on barges and shipped south. So, I mean, in terms of eradication, once it's desiccated or once it's removed from the water and then we ship it south, then I believe that, that's a belief that it'll, that's how it'll be dealt with in terms of that, Mr. Chairman.
So you're simply removing it from the environment? Simply removing it from the environment?
That is correct.
Okay. And can we follow up?
Are you working on flaggy?
Have you done a survey to make sure that it's not present on other pilings throughout the harbor or other? And I don't know, is A and B Harbor the basically the main Sitka Harbor, or is it a satellite harbor?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Feige, I'd have to go back. I believe that species was identified at the same time as that in 2010 that D-Vex was found, but in terms of having those survey results, I don't have them in front of me, so I'd have to get back to you on that.
Okay, if you would, that'd be appreciated. Thanks.
And if you could get that to me, I'll distribute it to the whole committee because everybody's interested in this topic. Representative Christ Tompkins.
Does the department know how the tunicate species in A&B Harbor got there? Its origin, or
Mr. Chairman, Representative Christ Tompkins, I don't have that on the top of my head, and I don't want to speculate, but I can certainly try and get that information for you.
Thank you. Yeah, and if you'd get that to me as chair, I'll make sure everybody does. Because that's one, it'd be really interesting to know if we were doing any genetic stuff. Tests on it to find out whether it came from the same areas that the D-Vex came from, whether they're different. So that way, as we go forward with bills here, we can make sure we address all the moving pieces at one time. So thank you. We'll look forward to that information. Are there any other questions for Mr. Swanton? Thank you for the presentation and the update. I guess I had one other question for you. I just remembered. It was back here where we were talking about whether it was North Pacific Research or whether it was Smithsonian. You said they're trying several different things in slightly larger areas or boxes to see if they will control, and you mentioned powdered cement or something. What is the range of control measures that have been postulated with Smithsonian to work on this? I mean, are we talking about, and we know that when the salt was applied before, it didn't work except on the top of the surface, and if we're, can you tell me what the range of control measures are that they have been willing to come forward with?
Mr. Chairman, it was hypersaline solution, acetic acid, cement dust, and I think that there was a combination in there, and that's what we're planning on investigating. I can, probably the best thing, if you're interested in that, is to get you a copy of the publication that they put out with regards to the trials and how they went about it in terms of the you know, there was different mortality schedules at you know, relatively short time periods, 2 to 4 hours, and then they'd, and so it's fairly comprehensive, and I think that what we're planning on doing is just taking those, you know, aquarium-sized trials and expanding those to 1 to 3 meter, you know, treatments, and seeing if that, those results still continue. So I can certainly get you a copy of that, which is, lays out pretty much how we're planning on going about business, but on very smaller scale, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, that would be helpful, and it'd also be helpful to know if you know, we, in every single processing plant around the state, we use powdered chlorine for disinfecting and all the surfaces. I mean, it's something that's readily available and everything else. Has chlorine been used, or powdered chlorine been attempted to use on this? And I just want to find out, if not, why haven't we gone that direction?
That we want to have to get back to you. I mean, there's been the treatments that I described were the ones that I can recall from when I took a look at the report. I know that they were looking at, you know, almost like a, you know, since it is the Olympics, you know, something along the lines of like a hockey puck that you put in there that dissolves over the course of time and keeps that concentration up. They were looking at whether it be a liquid treatment, whether it be a powder treatment, whether it be these pucks or so on and so forth. It's fairly comprehensive, but I can't recall whether chlorine was part of it or not.
Okay, I'd be appreciative of getting that. Anything else for Mrs. Swan? Thank you again. Next, we have the Deputy Commissioner of DNR. Welcome, Mr. Fogles. Would you put yourself on the record and go ahead and let us know where we're standing with the MOU and also with Elodia?
Sure. Mr. Chairman, my name is Ed Fogles, Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources, and thank you and members of the committee for the opportunity to talk to you today. And I will give you kind of an update on where we are in our efforts to fight another invasive species, Elodia. You all are aware that on January 15th of last year, we did sign an MOU. Commissioner Cora Campbell of Fish and Game, Commissioner Larry Hardig of DEC, and I signed an MOU regarding aquatic invasives, freshwater aquatic invasives, specifically Elodia. That MOU is important in that it clearly stated that the agencies consider Elodia to be noxious, degrading fish habitat and displacing native flora and fauna, and put the responsibility on DNR to coordinate our efforts to deal with this invasive species. And I think most importantly, it drew kind of a line that if it's a freshwater invasive, then it's sort of it's in DNR's court. And so I think that was pretty critical, and it sort of mapped out a plan forward. A big part of that plan is we created a Elodia working group. The core is technical experts from DNR, Fish and Game, and DEC, and we're pulling in other people, other stakeholders, folks from the Soil and Water Conservation Districts, and federal agencies. I just also mentioned that within DNR we have an invasive species program located in the Division of Agriculture. We have an invasive species coordinator, Breanne Blackburn. She is my technical lead within DNR on this, and unfortunately she was on leave this week, where I would have had her here to back me up and answer the really tough questions. So I will do the best I can. So I just start by saying there are three battlegrounds for Elodia in the state, and starting up north in Fairbanks, there's a very significant infestation in Chena's Slough. This is one place that I visited myself the fall before last. I canoed with some folks down Chena's Slough and saw Elodia myself. Very thick. It was pretty impressive in how choking it was in that water body. Instead of a nice clear grayling fishery, now you had Elodia growing there within an inch of the surface, so it was hard to paddle through. And you could look down in the water between gaps in the Elodia, and you can see fish just stacked up between the Elodia. Very clear to me. a non-expert that the fish didn't want to be there. They wanted to be where the Alodia wasn't. So very dramatic. And so the Fairbanks Soil and Water Conservation District has kind of been the local lead on trying to figure out how to deal with Chinas slough. And they've been looking at some mechanical methods of removal, doing some experimentation. Mechanical methods have a disadvantage in that Alodias can propagate very easily. A one-inch piece breaking off could float down and repropagate somewhere else. So there's a lot of focus on chemical methods. It's a lot harder to figure out how to use chemical methods in flowing water than in still water. So the Fairbanks folks have a pretty unique problem up there. They've been doing a lot. I don't think they've got solutions yet, but they still have been trying to fine-tune how to do the mechanical method, at least to keep the biomass down. The second battleground is the Kenai Peninsula. The Homer Soil and Water Conservation District has been partnering with a number of other agencies and groups to look at a couple of lakes, Stormy Lake and Daniels Lake. And we have actually permitted the use of a herbicide for those lakes. And there are other permits that still need to be acquired, but the hope is that can be tried even as early as this summer. We can get the funding for that. But again, herbicides for Alodia have not been used in Alaska and northern climates, so there's still a lot of concern as to how they would behave and what their other impacts might be on the ecosystem. But I think everyone's aligned now, the stakeholders in the Kenai, to try it on one of the lakes in the Kenai. The third battleground is in Anchorage. There are a number of lakes that have infestations. The prime one that we're looking at is Sand Lake. That's right in the heart of Anchorage. It's surrounded by private property, and it's a heavy floatplane use lake. So there's more considerations there about how it spreads, gets caught up in floatplane rudders, and that gets potentially transmitted to other lakes. So we are working closely with the Anchorage Soil and Water Conservation District there. They've had some capital appropriations to look at the lake, to map out Alodia, and to look for possible solutions. They've been investigating a third way, a way of utilizing certain microbes that would go in and eat the sediments, and the theory is that could help make it in the lake inhospitable for Alodia, although they haven't presented that information to the agencies yet, so I'm waiting for a report from the Anchorage District here real soon that summarizes their activities to date and their recommendations. And maybe that we try the microbe route, or we might actually try and have a discussion with the homeowners about potential use of herbicides in the future. Again, there are a lot of homeowners that live around the lake, and a lot of those have wells, so I think there's a lot of concern about the use of chemicals in a lake, and we're going to have to work through all that and before we can propose some kind of a chemical solution in a lake like that. We did hold a big public meeting as part of this working group at the Sand Lake Elementary School in December and brought all the homeowners in. And so we're having that dialogue with the homeowners. There's a lot of concern that there's a heavy floatplane traffic in that lake. So I think that a big push this summer will be, as we're trying to figure out whether microbes or herbicides are the way to go in Sand Lake, we're also going to try and get some funding to do some mechanical removal. And that way, at least we can bring down the biomass and minimize the chances of Alodia getting wrapped up in floatplane rudders and such and getting transmitted. So hopefully we'll see some on-the-ground action with respect to mechanical removal in the lake this summer. That's our hope.
Representative Feige.
Speaking of floatplanes, has anybody looked over Lake Hood and the Anchorage Airport to see if you've got any Alodia in there?
Representative Feige, through the chair, my understanding is that that Lake Hood has other weed issues, mm-hmm. But at this point we are not aware, to my knowledge, that there is Alodia in Lake Hood. Maybe wrong on that, I can get back to you, but I have not aware of Alodia in Lake Hood at this time. I know they do mechanical harvesting of other weeds to maintain the floatplane pond.
Reverend Feige.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And yes, I am familiar with those weeds. I'm a little whacker they have that runs around, but whatever they're mechanically dealing with at Lake Hood is not necessarily invasive species. It's a locally sort of a naturally occurring, whatever it is.
Representative Feige, you do the job, I believe so, but I'd have to verify that, and we'll get back to the committee on that.
Okay, thanks. I had a question, and that is, I believe on the Kenai that there was a plan to restrict or eliminate float plane traffic into the lakes there. I think there's two, Stormy and Daniels?
Yeah,
and I think one was used for a float plane, and there's, I think they're restricting float plane use there. Is that also considered for Anchorage or Sandlin?
Mr. Chairman, yeah, we did restrict boat traffic and float plane use. I think it was in Stormy Lake, but that's we had the authorities there through our state park system to be able to do that. I don't think DNR does not have the that same authority over Sand Lake to restrict any kind of float plane use or boat use. So we don't have that ability.
Commissioner, I had hoped that with this MOU that you would send us in the next few days what you would need for extending that ability in an invasive species outbreak to restrict either vessel or float plane access, because we, you know, that hasn't been brought to our attention yet. But I mean, the biggest thing on invasive is stop the further spread, and if we have a float plane lake that's used there and goes over and is in the Matsu or further in other lakes down in the Kenai or across the west side, we don't want to be looking at trying to do incipient populations in a number of lakes just because we didn't give you the authority to make people go to Lake Hood instead of there until the agreed upon eradication method is completed. So would you please make sure that we get that right away?
We'll do that, Mr. Chair. And again, you know, we see the issue there too. And so again, as I mentioned, one of the things we will do is try and at least cut down the biomass so that the possibilities of that transmittal are at least reduced to some the extent that we can do it. But we will get back to the committee on that.
Okay, because I just want to be clear that we, at least on this committee, I don't think, are wanting to institute ongoing control measures that people say, well, that works good enough, we'll just keep doing that in the operation budget for the next 20 years and not address the problem. So, you know, I'm concerned that if we do RFPs for eradication or control, we're going to get control responses back, and they may be cheaper in a certain time frame, but that doesn't eliminate the potential of having those spread. So we definitely will be looking for that. Representative Chris Tompkins.
So your department has resources and staff to address invasive species, and so does the Department of Fish and Game. How does the Department of Natural Resources jurisdiction or bailiwick or purview differ from that of the Department of Fish and Game when it comes to addressing and eradicating invasive species?
Representative Christ Tompkins, through the chair. It's going to be hard for me to compare. I don't know. I'm not as familiar with Fish and Game's authorities, but I can clearly outline to you what DNR's authorities are. Well, first off, we have the invasive species program within the Division of Agriculture, and so we have hard-funded position to coordinate our efforts and work with other agencies, as I mentioned earlier. We also the director of the Division of Agriculture has the authority to quarantine pests. And as I was going to get to in a minute here, we are looking at quarantining Elodia. We've talked about that for
for a while within the working group, and we're ready to issue a public notice. I hope to have that out maybe even as early as next week sometime. That would alert the world that that the director of the Division of Agriculture is considering quarantining Elodia, which would prohibit its import, sale, or distribution. So that's a clear authority that we can have. We've done that with other invasive species, but that's typically, it's a little fuzzy, but part of this MOU, where DNR focuses really the land management component, so land and fresh water is kind of mostly what we're looking at. We've never really been involved in the marine aquatic invasives, although I think when I think about our authorities with marine invasives, we do issue aquatic farming leases with stipulations on them, so that's where we may be able to come in. I'm not sure how far our authorities go to require certifications and such, but that's something to definitely for DNR to look at. Another authority that we have that we've already discussed is restricting motorized use. There are places on situations in Alaska where we can restrict motorized use, and typically they're in legislatively designated areas, state parks, wildlife refuges. I mean, between DNR and Fish and Game, we've restricted jet boat use in Ketchikan Bay at this time. There are places where we have restricted vessel traffic and motorized traffic. It's not easy to do. There's typically a lot of opposition to that, and typically it has to be a special area for us to be able to do that.
I guess I'm concerned with the Sand Lake example as being a hub for spreading. Mm-hmm. So who does have control over some? Is that DOT or is that FAA, or who would be the agency? And if it's DOT, do we need to add them into the memorandum of understanding on a lake with invasive species, and or is, can you get back? If you don't know off the top of your head who has the regulatory authority on that, would you get back to us right away?
Mr. Chair, I will get back to you. I really, but my guess is that the water of the lake is state. The water is owned by the state. The land under the water is state, and it's managed by the Department of Natural Resources. I don't think the FAA likely has jurisdiction to restrict air traffic for biological reasons is my guess, but we would have to look at that. So DNR is the land manager, but floodplain use is a generally allowed use of state lands, and we typically do not restrict that. There are places where it's restricted, again, in a state park, but DNR general state lands, we do not restrict it. The municipality has its powers too. They may have some room there, but again, you've got a lot of So we can kind of try and flesh that out a little bit more and get back to the committee.
Okay, that'd be good, because if we need to have some specific authority for state lands when in conjunction with an incipient invasive species, until eradication can be accomplished or something, mm-hmm. The whole legislature would need to consider it, but it's something that we need to talk about. But if there's any other issues that come up in that light that you think of, that there are places where we have gaps that we haven't filled within legislation that's moving through, we're asking for you to make us aware of those. Go ahead.
Okay. Just to wrap up with a few of the other things that we're sort of doing in the bigger statewide picture, we have tapped into the expertise of Dr. Lars Anderson, who's a very renowned expert on aquatic invasives, and he's been up here a number of times. He attended our Sand Lake meeting, and it's very helpful. So we're really tapping into his expertise to help us come up with a bigger plan forward. We have the working group is developing an aquatic invasives communication plan and a sort of a staff training module so we can communicate to the public as to the dangers of Elodia, and so the public is aware of what it looks like,
and our field staff that are out in the field for a variety of reasons. They understand what Alodia looks like. They can report back. That's all sort of being developed right now by the working group, again, led by our invasive species coordinator. And then in a bigger picture, we're just gathering the info and building a database of where we find Alodia in Alaska so we can track it. So those are the, sort of the core things that we are pursuing with this working group right now. So all in all, I mean, you know, we've formed this working group a year ago. I know that some would have liked us to have made more progress. I think in some areas we've done really well. In other areas we can do better. But we are working the issue, and we're working it hard.
And how about the funding? Is there funding there available for the work that's going, and where are we related there?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, you know, as I mentioned, within DNR, we are hard funded for our invasive species program. That sort of provides the overall coordination statewide. For specific projects, though, that funding is project specific, and DNR does not have any funding in its budget for those specific projects. That's typically we've relied on other stakeholders. Like, typically, I think a very important stakeholder are the soil and water conservation districts. You know, they have been going out and receiving grant funding or at times capital funding. The Anchorage Soil and Water Conservation District has received capital funding to kind of evaluate Sand Lake, and that's going to be the resulting in their report that they bring to the agencies here probably any minute now. And I think that's sort of how the Kenai battle is shaping up too. The districts and the Kenai Watershed Forum have been getting funding, and some of the federal agencies have been chipping in too. So I think, again, you'll see that for each battleground, I think we're going to rely on a lot of the stakeholder folks out there to help us raise funds to do that. But it will ultimately, I mean, we're looking at the coordination and the study, but to actually do the eradication on the ground will cost money, you know, it's not going to be pennies. It's going to be a fair bit of money. You know, our estimates are always, the estimates I keep hearing are $200,000-$300,000 per lake, you know, average size lake. So, and that's what we're trying to dial in, is when we figure out if the herbicides are effective, can they be used safely, and really dial in the costs so that when we see a lake and we see an infestation, we've got the permitting part figured out, because right now permitting is not easy. And we're trying to work, that's one of the reasons, the prime reasons that DEC is on this working group, is they can help us with the pesticide, the herbicide permitting part, so that we don't have to wait a year to get permits when we find an infestation, that we have something that the Alaskans have agreed on. We can go in there and let everyone know what we're going to do and do it.
And in that respect, again, if you can let us know if there are solutions that are drawn up, if we need to give specific authority for extending that to other incipient populations that, you know, that have worked out, or if we've got that covered well enough, that's fine. If we don't have that covered well enough, what permits do you still have outstanding that you don't have for the Alodia?
Mr. Chairman, in the Kenai and Stormy Lakes, there's a DNR land use permit. Let me look here. I'll find out for you in a second. We have a DEC pesticide use permit in hand for one of the herbicides, Diquat, and we're still pending for another DEC permit for another pesticide called Sonar. So that one's still in the works. We have a fish and game habitat permit and a Division of Mining, Land, and Water land use permit that are still pending. But really, those should not be a big issue, as long as it's all about the DEC permit. We get those figured out, then the permits really should be fairly straightforward.
And those are moving at the pace you would expect. You don't.
Yep.
See. When the soil and water conservation district gives you that. If it's public, would you send that to the committee so that we can have that Sand Lake analysis?
Yes, sir. We can do that.
Great. And like I say, if it's internal to the agency, I'm not asking for it then. But as soon as it's public, we won't have to wait until we hear about it and go find it. So that would be helpful. Are there any other questions? Seeing none, appreciate everybody's attendance. I guess I should ask, was there anybody else in the audience that had any input for us on these presentations we had today? Okay, thank you, and we will be adjourned at 11:24.